Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's lecture, beginning of a new series entitled The Breakaways. This new series is in part inspired by our last series, where we looked at the writings of women in the Sephardic community in London and the Americas in the 19th century. And we saw that many of their writings were responses to questions of change that was taking place within the Jewish community in the 19th century. And so what I decided to do for this term was to actually look at the change itself, to actually look at different communities that were being impacted by this change in the most profound way, and that it actually inspired these breakaways. Jewish joke of, you know, the guy on the Jewish island, you know, a guy on the island, and he, you know, is there, and someone else comes to, you know, to rescue him, and he's showing them around the island before they go, and he says, you know, this is my synagogue, and, you know, this is my home, and this is, you know, where I do my laundry, and this is my synagogue, and the guy says, oh, wait, I thought that was your synagogue. He says, well, you know, I have two synagogues. This is the one I go to when I'm angry at that one. This is the one I go to when I'm angry at that one. You know, so it's kind of the Jewish joke about, you know, kind of, you know, one Jew, two synagogues. But, you know, joking aside, it was a profound rupture within these communities during the 19th century. And in many of those situations, there was only, perhaps only had been one synagogue in the town. And so it really was a really division within the entire Jewish community. And in other places, there may have been, in a sense, already two synagogues, one Ashkenazi, one Sephardi, but still the kind of the breakaway from whichever synagogue was breaking away from really pulled apart the community. And we're going to be looking at four particular communities where this takes place. Tonight we're going to be looking at Hamburg, which takes place in 1818, so exactly two centuries ago. This is going to be the first Reform synagogue that's set up, right? So that's really significant kind of in the history of Reform Judaism, Western Judaism, and so on. So that's 1818. We're then going to be looking at a community that's going to be in New York. It's going to be the first breakaway there, B'nai Jeshurun. That's going to be in 1825. We're then going to be looking at West London, which is approximately 1840. And then we're going to be looking in Charleston, South Carolina, at their first breakaway, which is Sheriff Israel, which is going to be in 1841. Okay, so this is going to be the communities we're going to look at. We're talking about a very small moment of time, but this is a time of monumental shifts that are going to be taking place within the Jewish world, and we're going to see them through these particular synagogues. Now, the selection of these synagogues are not because there were never any other breakaways in these places, but it's chosen a few particular criteria with which to select these synagogues. One, none of these, and we'll see some of it be a bit of a quest, none of them, seemingly at least, are simply about Ashkenazi Sephardic divides, right? Of course, we'll have in London in 1690 a breakaway from Bevis Marks, right? It's not even Bevis Marks yet, right? From the synagogue in Creature Lane. We'll also have an Ashkenazi community, right? That's not entirely surprising. There's people who have a different background, a different, religious tradition, and so they're going to set up their own synagogue. That's not particularly divisive, even though the communities will be very separate, but it'll essentially be two separate worlds, right, that essentially are set up. You'll have a situation in Philadelphia in the 1850s where they'll set up another synagogue, in part because the rabbi in one synagogue may be forced out, and there's people who really like that rabbi, and so they follow Isaac Luser and set up a second synagogue separate from Mikveh Israel. But again, that has more to do with kind of personalities and those kinds of politics, not really about what we're going to be looking at, which is religious change, right? And kind of the reactions that are taking place to the changes within the world and within the Jewish world in particular. What we're going to see is that the story for each of these is different. It's not, okay, we're just going to go through all the first reform breakaway synagogues, because they're not all reform. This synagogue is not reform. This synagogue is not reform, right? But they're all centering around those kinds of issues. And so what we're going to see through these four communities is really the different way that the changes that are taking place is going to throw, you know, Jewish communities throughout the West, right, throughout the, kind of the Anglo-American world, into, you know, upheaval. And that's obviously going to be a change that will then continue afterwards. But what we're looking at is kind of the initial phase of that rupture that's going to take place, right, before you have kind of the mass migrations of Central and Eastern European Jews into these places, right. We're looking into a world which is still Sephardic, right. There are also some Ashkenazi synagogues, obviously Ashkenazi community in London as well. But we're gonna be looking at the way that these breakaways actually all impact or are related to the Sephardic community, where they're coming from in many places, whether in New York and in Charleston, where there's only a Sephardic synagogue in those places. But all of the breakaways have a lot and have a real impact on the Sephardic community, right? To the extent that we saw in that last term, all of these writings that are being put forward by these ladies in the Spanish and Portuguese community, right, out of Bevis Marks, because this is not just something that's happening, you know, among the Ashkenazim, right? It's their problem, not our problem, right? As people often kind of talk about it and say, oh, reform is an Ashkenazi phenomenon, not Sephardic. And while that's overwhelmingly true, it's not entirely true, and it's not certainly not true within this, what we'll look at is a really kind of an initial phase of reform, which is going to be different than the reform that's going to set in after the 1840s. And we'll kind of see that throughout this this series. But we're looking kind of a first stage of reform, which is relates to the Sephardic community in a really interesting way. Right? We're going to get to learn a lot about what the Spanish Portuguese community is about, what these changes are about, the dealing with the New World, and so on. Okay? Now, what we're going to be seeing is that, as I mentioned, each of these breakaways are really going to be telling us a different story. They're each going to have different objectives, they're going to have different issues that are at play. But collectively, they're going to tell the story of change within the Spanish and Portuguese community and the Western Jewish world in the 19th century, which is going to essentially create the Jewish world that we know today. Okay? So this is an incredibly important moment in time. And as I mentioned, you know, several times in the last series, that this moment is very similar in certain ways to our moment in history as well. And we'll see that even more in this series. But on a basic level, by the time you get to the 1820s, the majority of Jews living in these places are native-born Jews. And that will be the last time that will be the case until you get, you know, to, you know, the most recent generations, right, in America, in England, and so on. Because you think of all the immigration that will take place from Central Europe and then Eastern Europe, right, to the extent that you're not going to have a majority native population of native-born Jews until you get to that time. And that, as we're going to see, a lot of the currents within society at that time are actually really similar to the currents within our society now as well. And you could almost imagine, if these breakaways hadn't happened then, you could almost imagine that they would happen now, right? That there's really kind of this moment in time that we're in. So in studying about, you know, these writings and these communities, it does feel a little bit like we're studying about ourselves, right? Whether kind of just ourselves, meaning the world that we find ourselves in, or even particularly within our Spanish and Portuguese, you know, community as well, and kind of some of the different challenges and currents and things that we deal with, as well. So, does anybody have any questions? I'm going to pause at different moments and ask for questions. Yes?
So the reform breakaway in Hamburg, is that, I mean, you'll probably go into that, but was that also like a seed for the Ashkenazi breakaway, or did that happen at a later stage?
So we'll take a look at that. It is going to be primarily an Ashkenazi synagogue. It's not a Spanish-Portuguese. Hamburg will be different than the other communities we're going to look at, but it's going to relate to the Spanish-Portuguese in a really interesting way, which is going to lay the groundwork for understanding what's going on. Okay, so yeah, good question. for those of you that are wondering, this is the first synagogue, right? The one that's on the screen over here, right? This is a depiction of what that synagogue looked like in 1818. Okay, so that was the first purpose-built reform synagogue, reform community. So, but let's take a look back, because this moment that we're in, historians love to do periodization, right? To kind of put moments into brackets. So if I were to ask you what era we are in at this time, what would you say?
Post-modern.
Okay, that's an interesting way to say it, right? Let's try to get some, that's true, and we're gonna talk about that. But let's broaden the term, because right, post-Napoleon isn't true if you're in Charleston. Right, you don't think of it in that way. So let's think of a term though that encompasses this entire time period.
Let's talk about Hamburg.
Right, yeah.
Is it kind of the something through the Industrial Revolution?
The Enlightenment.
Enlightenment. So let's just use some even broader terms that, right, the historians are going to use, right? They're gonna break history up. Typically, or classically, they would have done it into two different time periods, right? You would have had the right, medieval, right? And then you would have also had, maybe spell that, medieval, and then you will have the modern, right? So first you have to define what is medieval and what is modern, right? Why is one time period called medieval? Why is another time period called modern? So what would you guys say? First of all, we're gonna have to give dates to these things as well. But if I were to ask you, what is medieval time period, what would you say?
Traditionally in Europe, medieval is up to 1492.
Okay, so you want to say this goes up to 1492, okay? And why? Why is that the time that you would divide?
It wasn't just the discoveries of the state of North America and the great sea voyages to new lands like Magellan and things like that. But it was also the turning point where it was the almost a resurgence of science. It was the culmination of the process that saw learning.
So you want to call this, what some people would call this, the Dark Ages.
It's the end of the Dark Ages.
Right, and that this is going to be, right, the Renaissance.
Yes.
Right, okay, and that might be one way to divide these two things, okay? So that's one way to kind of look at that. It's interesting date to choose 1492 for the beginning of the Renaissance, right? Because what some other years are you could be for Renaissance?
But the Renaissance, again, traditionally ends with the French Revolution, and which later, at least in Europe, or the American Revolution on your side of the pond, and later it moves to the period of Enlightenment.
Okay.
Because the Enlightenment is 19th century.
So I'm saying, so if you have to put things into two categories, medieval and modern, right, the question is, what's the difference between the two?
Well,
right, meaning obviously...
None of it is government as well, because before the medieval period, which you could really go up to the 18th century, was more of a feudal system, and you got more modern government, particularly around, as you say, with the French Revolution.
So that's good. So what do you mean by modern government?
Well, you've got more, it's not ruled exclusively by the aristocracy.
Yeah, the class system. The middle class.
It's not just that the ruling class is born there. A lot of it's to do with trade and industry, where people are coming up through the ranks, and they're having, and commerce and merchants, they're having more of a role in society.
So maybe we'll call this, I think, right, individual rights.
Yeah.
But it's also the rise of Protestantism.
Okay, yes. Right? So that's going to be, right, so you're going to divide based on that, right? You're going to say this is time is Catholic, right? And then obviously in the 16th century, right, then you're going to have Protestantism as well.
Primitive press.
Sorry?
The printing press.
Printing press.
Communication.
Okay.
And it's also the birth of nation states.
Okay, right, so states. So good. So that's a big significance, right, to kind of go ahead and say, 15th century is going to be this way, everything afterwards is going to be different. So how similar do you think our life is today to the 1500s? Meaning, is our world structured the same way as in the 1500s?
No, it's far more global now. Communications broken down a lot more barriers. It's completely different, say, from the Second World War. If you look at the kind of media you had, it was just newspapers and newsrooms. Now the internet.
Right, so some people will look at it and say the world has profoundly changed during not just Renaissance, but specifically when you talk about the Enlightenment. Right? And then the idea of individual rights, that doesn't really begin in the year 1500, right? When do you get individual rights?
More or less 16th, towards the 18th century. It starts then.
Right, 18th into 19th century, right? That's only when you're going to get these things, right? So let's even write that, right? 18, right, into 19th century, right? That's when you're going to start to get individual rights. Enlightenment, right? That's 18th century, okay? You're going to have, someone mentioned, I think, Leslie, you mentioned the Industrial Revolution,
yeah.
Right? When's that?
The 19th century.
Yeah, well, it depends where exactly, but again, you're looking 18th to 20th century, right? Where you're kind of having, right? Depends what you mean by Industrial Revolution, whether you mean, kind of the idea of, making it that you have everyone wears the same shirts, or whether you actually mean the steam engines and electricity, right? So it'll be a little bit, but certainly the Industrial Revolution, right? So here you're looking at things that are talking about the 18th, 19th century, right? And then in many regards, the things before that time, the world still feels in certain ways very medieval, right? We haven't entered, this modern era. So a lot of the question of periodization is going to be determined based on what characteristics are using to define the time period in question, right? And depending on how you want to define it, you might almost then want to say the medieval time goes all the way up into the 18th century. But we don't really want to say that, right? But on the other hand, to say that the modern era is in the 1500s, right, feels kind of strange as well. So what historians have more recently done was add a new category, which they call early modern, right? Which is a bad term, because it's kind of somewhere in between medieval and modern. In some ways, it has characteristics of the medieval world. In certain regards, it has characteristics of the modern world. Yes, Derek.
Somewhere in that area, you've got the beginnings of massive change in society because you've got the end of the feudal system in terms of serfs or whatever you call them in different countries.
Yeah.
The rise of the middle class in relation to industrialization.
Right, so exactly. So how you define these periods, are you defining it based on, intellectualism, right? Is it about ideas? Is it about... is it an economy? Are you defining it based on governance? Are you defining it based on, the class system? Right? Depending on what characteristic you use, right, there's not going to be, it's like there's this moment where, yesterday it was this, and today it's all going to be this, right? Correct. Things obviously shift over time, right? And so this moment of the kind of the early modern is almost this time period that we want to look at, which is kind of going to be the, everything before is one way, everything after is another way, but then we have these centuries, where things are shifting and they're going to shift in different ways in different places over time. But obviously,
there's another factor in that actually affects the Jewish community in general. When wealth and power moves from land owning to entrepreneurial, you have the rise of a Jewish middle class, but when the wealth was tied to ownership of land, he didn't have that many wealthy Jews, because most of Europe and the Mediterranean, Jews couldn't own land.
Well, the wealthy ones were moneylenders.
Sorry?
The wealthy ones were the moneylenders,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's going to change how that's going to work. Excellent, very good. So that actually put me in that point. But when you think about the Jewish community, right, so for us, right, how are we going to define, right, these periodizations, right, for changes in the Jewish world, right? So if you want to say, we think of medieval as, when Jews are expelled and persecuted, I'll say, what about, 1940? So the 1940s still the medieval times? I mean, we were persecuted more in the 1940s than we were in the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century combined, probably, right? Meaning we never had just wholesale slaughter of Jewish people across nation after nation after nation, right? So, so that becomes a little bit uncomfortable, right? When we start thinking about, you know, what are the characteristics of the time period when, in some ways, it's going to get a little bit messy. So the Holocaust kind of, I think, makes us have to kind of question all of the periodization, so that it almost, we almost need to put it to the side, right, in order to be able to kind of have this question, of to still be able to look at kind of broad stroke developments. And part of the question about Jewish community will be, you know, is it Jewish kind of periodization, or the way we think about the Jewish community, simply the same as whatever is going on in general society, or are there changes kind of in our internal development that's going to be significant for how we define the Jewish community? So let's take that question, right? In terms of Jewish history, if you had to kind of categorize and kind of say, you know, qualities of the Jewish era, right, what would you use to define that? Yeah, Leslie.
A pivotal point would be the end of the English Civil War and the rise of the Protector Oliver Cromwell.
Specifically England.
He invited the Jews as in response to Manasseh Ben Israel's request to resettle in England from a religious point of view.
Sure.
But actually, I think his real reason, although he was very devout Christian, his real reason was to build up the trade and the commerce of England after the Civil War. Because it's not a coincidence that the Bank of England was founded not that long after the Jews came back to England. And Jews had international trading links. So they were really important to build up the finance.
So that's a good point. That's a good point. Jews were actually super important in terms of the rise of the Dutch Golden Age, less important for England, actually less significant. If Jews had never come to England, England probably would have still become what it became, just in terms of kind of, we can see the numbers of people and their percentage. The Dutch probably wouldn't have. The Jews played a really large role kind of in their development. But you do raise a good point, right, in terms of just kind of thinking about, so when is, you know, when does the, what is the modern era of Judaism, right, or the Jewish people, right? How are we going to kind of define, you know, medieval Jewry versus modern Jewry, right? So what might be some of the things that we're going to look at in terms of that? Yes, there.
Well, you can look at population density. Because at the beginning of your early modern period, Jews lived in small communities. Cities were relatively small. Jews weren't often allowed to live in cities. And the communication between these groups was tenuous, to say the least. But most of them had a level of orthodoxy that was higher than those that weren't in those small communities. Because if they left, they didn't necessarily take detail in their religion with them.
Okay, so how do you want to kind of start separating?
Well, somewhere around the period post-Henry VIII.
Sorry.
Not necessarily here, but that sort of 1600.
Because
population started moving. I mean, you had certain places like Venice, which had a Jewish community.
Right.
But you had lots of small groups.
So you're saying kind of the concentration into cities?
They concentrated into cities because they gave up being on the land to develop things.
Okay. So what is that?
Well, partly because of the opportunities, partly because there's safety in numbers.
But when does that happen?
After 1600.
Okay. So you want to say kind of this is rural and this is urban?
Yeah.
For Jews? Okay.
Yeah.
Fine. What else? How else would we kind of define to? What other kind of definitions?
They got skills. They became silversmiths. They became
tailors.
It also depends on which part of the world you're talking about, because in the Mediterranean, with Venice, Livorno, Istanbul, and the coast of North Africa, the communication with far more.
Correct. So that's going to be really important. One is the question of location, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning, so one might use religion as a way to create the periodization, and might want to say, well, it's the advent of reform, right, which is the modern era, right, which means that the modern era only begins, right, in the 19th century. But There's no reform in Poland, right? So is Poland not in the modern era in the 19th century? Are Iraqi Jews not in the modern era in the early 20th century because they don't have reform? So location is going to be really important kind of in terms of thinking about this, and again, what characteristics we're going to use to define it. And one of the really important characteristics to maybe think about is going to be the question of rights, right? Meaning, when are Jews seen as a corporation, and when are Jews seen as people, right? So in the Middle Ages, Jews are a unit, right? Jews are owned, essentially. They're property of the king, or they're properties of the bishop. You're not looked at as an individual, unless you're maybe the court Jew, right? Essentially, you're part of the system, and the community pays a tax, right? It's not gonna be the individuals, it's the community pays a tax, right? And then at a certain point, there's a shift where it's not community, it's individuals that are gonna be doing that. And that shift happens at different times in different places, right? So you mentioned Cromwell and Jews coming to England. So when Jews get here in the 1650s, are they a class or are they individuals?
They're class.
Why would you say that?
Because they acted as a class. They accumulated space for themselves.
Well, let me ask you that. If a Jew broke the law here, would they get tried by the Jewish court or by the general court?
By the general court.
So they weren't being treated then as a class, right, of you Jews govern yourselves. They're actually being seen as, on some level, subjects, right? And so in certain ways, right, Jews that are here in the 1600s are already somewhat more seen as individuals than they were in other places where they're still seen simply as a collective. For example, there are no laws in England governing the Jewish community. There is no Jewish law on the books in England. While there will be Jews treated as the Jewish community in Livorno into the 19th century,
Venice.
Right? And so you're gonna have all of these kinds of things happening where you're gonna, what does it mean to be in the modern era is gonna be a little bit difficult. So if we wanna say kind of full emancipation, that's the modern era, right? So when is full emancipation? Sorry, I'll take you back. When is full emancipation?
The 19th century.
Well, again, it'll be different times in different places. In some places, it goes one way, then takes a step back, and then goes forward again. Right? But in England, Jews don't have the right to take office without taking a Christian oath until the 1850s, right? So even though they've been living as, in a sense, individuals since the 1650s, they don't receive full emancipation until the 1850s. But they are here as individuals. So is this the modern era, or is this the modern era? So we have the early modern era, right? We have this kind of foggy time period that we're talking about. This transition into this time period that we're going to look at is really being kind of, from many different kind of perspectives of how you kind of define periodization, this is entering the modern era. So the Jews are finally, right, and the world is finally really entering a time period that we would kind of all say, this is the modern era. Right, by the time you get to the 19th century, right, you don't yet have the light bulb and you don't have airplanes, but this is really kind of in terms of the way our society functions and is structured, right, kind of post-enlightenment and so on, right, that's going to be this time period. So this is going to be kind of this kind of monumental shift that's happening in society, and certainly for the Jewish community, that for the first time, we're gonna have to really contend with what does that mean and what does it mean to be a Jew in this time period? Because even in the early modern period, where there are many aspects of modern, there are still this continuity within a sense the way we are treated and kind of our place in society with the medieval world. So we've had this kind of old structure in place, and all of a sudden, the world is different. Yes?
What we haven't talked about was sort of gender, and I'm wondering how it relates to urbanization. Have a situation where men are the ones in general that are going to the cities and therefore to get wives, if they're abiding by the old rules and regulations within the Orthodox community, they can't find Jewish women to marry. Therefore, the rules might need to be changed to allow them to marry Gentiles, which then opens up, you know, the door for the Reform movement as well.
So that's really a good question, like during moments of moving, right? You're going to certainly find that in America in the 1800s. There's all these stories of kind of the first people to go from Central Europe in the 1800s are going to be the men, and they're going to get there, and there's like no women, and then they're writing back, you know, to their families, and they're sending girls, you know, across, essentially for them to marry. But in a lot of these places in London, the Jewish community's been here since the 1600s. They're in the city. Their families are all here, right? So that's not really the issue that's happening. That's really going to be more in frontier areas where you're going to have those kinds of issues. Or maybe in a place like Berlin in the late 18th century, where you're just for the first time in Central Europe having Jews that are permitted to live in the cities, while prior they were forced to live more rurally. So it's going to, again, it's going to depend kind of where you are and what the situation is, right? Each of these places is really different from one another. Okay, good. So that's kind of all introduction. Obviously, that took a bit of time. But that's really important to kind of start thinking about these issues and kind of the way so many things are shifting during this time period. Okay. Okay, so let's just finish this then in one kind of final moment. When you think of emancipation in Britain, right? So we kind of already spoke about that, right? You kind of have this. Essentially, we're emancipated from the day we get here, right? From the time you get to the 1650s, Jews, there may be certain restrictions, right? There may be you can't do that trade, you can't take the oath of office, right? Those kinds of things. Right? We don't have full emancipation until the 1850s, but there's no Jewish tax. You're not obligated to be a member of the Jewish community. You can be a free agent, right? There is no kind of this state mandated, this is who you are and this is how you function, right? There is going to be individual freedom, right, in Britain from the beginning of Jews being here. And as a result, the Jewish community functions very different than, let's say, in Amsterdam and places like that, or Livorno, where that's not going to be the case, where there actually is a Jewish body and the rights of Jews are negotiated through this kind of this collective, and Jews are not just seen as other individuals. Here they're seen as other individuals, but with certain restrictions, right? And little by little, over the centuries, those restrictions are taken away. What about in America? What about in America?
The revolution.
Right, so yeah, so think about the American Revolution. So what is the status of Jews after the American Revolution? Right, Spanish Portuguese communities in Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, Savannah, Richmond, right? So what's the...
Emancipation.
Freedom.
Essentially, complete emancipation. There may be a specific states here or there that will hold on to certain restrictions, right? Usually in terms of office, but broadly speaking, I mean, Jews have full emancipation, right? That is a famous letter that George Washington sends to the Jewish community in Newport, Rhode Island, where he says that in America there will be no bigotry, right? That each person will be free to, you know, worship and to be a citizen, right? And the rights and privileges that a person has will be determined based on how good you are as a citizen, not going to be based on, you know, anything else, right? So America is kind of, obviously it's coming out of the English model, but it really kind of leaps it forward, right? So it kind of jumps it, right? And then obviously that's going to be seen by what's going on in France, right? Obviously all these things are happening at similar times. When you think of places like Germany, right, it's going to be a different process because Jews are going to have been there already, you know, in the old model, and the transition to a new model is a much more difficult type of process of when do you go ahead and simply pull the restrictions away. And in Germany, it's going to be particularly complicated because obviously you have Napoleon and then Jews are going to have emancipation. That's going to change. They're going to go back to the old model. It's kind of fits and starts that kind of take place. And what's going to happen, and this is going to relate to us, is there's going to be a little bit of a kind of quid pro quo type of situation where there's openness, it's enlightenment, there's openness to the idea that, you know, Jews should be given rights. In part, if we give them rights, they'll be more like us. And so part of the debate becomes, is do we give them rights and then they will kind of follow along, or do we wait for them to be more like us and then we'll give them the rights, right? And these are kind of the debates that are going to be happening, and these are obviously struggles that are going to be happening within the Jewish community as well, where they kind of see the opportunity, they see the possibility, and they want it, or many of them want that, right? Obviously, some of the power structure doesn't want it, because all of a sudden, you know, once Jews are just seen as individuals, the authority of the community is eroded, right? And so the ability for the community to ensure continuity and religious observance is eroded once they're no longer the ones in charge of the Jews, but the state is in charge of Jews, right? So there will be people who will be against emancipation in some of these places. And so there will be kind of this struggle that is going to be taking place about how exactly the process works and what people actually want and how you go about doing it. And that's going to bring us to Hamburg. Yes?
I'm like, what about the role of Freemasonry supporting the Jews, particularly with the founders of the United States?
Well, again, America is obviously heavily influenced by Enlightenment thought. That's the time period that they're
and
in.
And the fear of popery. In the
separation of church and state will be obviously significant. It will be significant in America, right? Something you will not have in this country, right? A separation of church and state. So yeah, that definitely plays a role. So let's take a look. Let's take a look at what we're talking about when we talk about Hamburg. And this is kind of going to be now actually looking, finally, after all that kind of introduction, looking at Hamburg. The new Israelite temple, the synagogue, the temple, they don't necessarily call it synagogue as much. You want to call it temple, which is established in 1818. It's exactly 2 centuries ago, right, during 2018 now, right, that their first Reform synagogue is done, and it will exist until Kristallnacht, okay, this community that's established, right? So it's founded, and it succeeds. There are other breakaways that I decide to not cover because they wrap after a couple years. They don't really make it. We may reference some of them at some point, right? This one really is established, and it succeeds. Now, Hamburg is an interesting place because it has both Sephardic and Ashkenazi communities that are there. So here are just one way of depicting that. Right, is the cemetery there, which is really cool. They have an amazing cemetery there. So you can see there, right, there are two different types of tombstones, right? There's the flat ones, that's from the Portuguese community, right? And then you have on the right, these standing stones. Those are actually of some very famous rabbis that were there. Yaakov Emden, Yonatan Eibschitz, Rabbi Katzenallen Bogen, right? Very famous rabbis that were in Hamburg in the Ashkenazi community. And to the left, you see the Portuguese. And it's essentially in the same land, just kind of one side are the flat stones and the other side are all these tall stones. It's a really evocative cemetery there. It's actually just outside of the technical Hamburg in a neighborhood called Altona. Jews weren't permitted to bury in Hamburg itself. The Sephardic community there was actually quite prominent in the 1600s when Hamburg was part of the, the Hanseatic League, and they're all kind of merchant opportunities and trade, right? So you think that Jews were in, you know, they were in Amsterdam and in Hamburg and then going to be in London, right? So that whole kind of area where they're going to be quite active, but certain rights are going to be taken away from them in the later 1600s, and many of the Sephardic Jews will leave and go to Amsterdam and to London as well. And so the Sephardic community will become smaller, though it will also persist after this time, but the Ashkenazi community will be kind of the more dominant group that's there. The Ashkenazi community will also kind of be based in Altona. The Sephardic community will be based more in Hamburg itself again, because the Portuguese will have some additional rights that the Ashkenazi Jews won't have, because the Portuguese are the merchants, they're the traders, right? They contribute in that way to the Hamburg economy, and so they'll have certain rights that the Ashkenazi Jews don't quite have. The Hamburg temple is essentially Ashkenaz. It's an Ashkenazi community. The people who make it up are mostly Ashkenazi Jews, but there is a very important Sephardic component to their story, which we're going to look at. The least of which, this is the least of it, is that their first chazan, his name is David Meldola, who's from Amsterdam, right? So a Portuguese chazan will become the first chazan of this reform, essentially Ashkenazi reform synagogue in Hamburg. And what we're going to look at is why they're selecting a Portuguese Jew to be their chazan. Why not have someone Ashkenaz to do it? It is going to set off a storm throughout Central Europe. And ultimately, this Hamburg temple is going to influence the West as well. And we're going to see references to Hamburg when we talk about some of these other communities as well. They are aware of it. In fact, one of the great influences that will come out of Hamburg is that there is a fair that takes place in Leipzig twice a year, where people come from all over the world, certainly all over Europe, and they will set up there kind of a Hamburg-type minyan, right, service that will meet during these trading moments, and you will have then kind of Jews from all over Europe who will go and see it and then kind of take some of those ideas back to the places that they come from, right? So you start kind of having the spread of this. Now, does anybody have any questions? Okay, so that's Hamburg Temple in a nutshell. What I want to look at is actually a bit about the development of Reform, because it will grow out of, in certain ways, out of the Ashkenazi world. So we'll see how it kind of, the Sephardic world will play a role with that as well. It comes out of Germany. And that's why kind of always the question of, you know, the modern era, there's often like a focus on a lot of, you know, Jewish histories that focus on Germany, even though, you know, there's a whole Jewish world. But this kind of moment of Reform, which obviously becomes something so significant, comes out of Germany, and, you know, the Jews there are engaged in society, intellectualism, and so on. So this is a big focus on Germany, and we'll think about that as we go through. The figure that's considered to be kind of the father of this, his name is Moses Mendelssohn. He is a great scholar in the 18th century, a philosopher, knowledgeable about Jewish sources as well as broader sources. He has relationships with many of the great philosophers. He's kind of considered to be this first, in that sense, kind of this first modern Jew. But we'll see that's not entirely fair to classify in that way. But within the Ashkenazi milieu, perhaps that's correct to say that he's kind of this first modern Jew. He's often associated with Reform, though he was not Reform. Reform didn't exist. And in fact, he was a observant Jew, a religiously observant Jew. If anything, we could perhaps define him as a modern Orthodox Jew, right? Would be a better definition if we had to kind of define him as one. But many of the people who will drive the Reform movement will consider them, will have been students of his, right? So people that kind of take this idea of kind of being part of the Western world and engaging in the Western world, but instead of kind of just embracing the way Judaism has always been, they're going to now head and say, well, now that we've embraced the Western world, we're going to adjust Judaism to, in their eyes, make it fit better with you know, this modern world that they find themselves in. Though Mendelssohn himself hadn't done that. Okay, so he's kind of an interesting figure. What people think about him in that he wasn't Reformed, but many of the Reformers related to him in such a way that you kind of end up tossing him into the reform camp. Now, this time that we're talking about, these early 1800s, is a time of religious change in the West. It's actually a time of a return to religion in the West, right? After kind of this period of the Enlightenment, after Napoleon, right? There's kind of this movement back to religion, right? Revivalism, Pietism. In America, they call it the Second Great Awakening. Right, there'll be this kind of return to religion that's going to take place, and it's a response to the Enlightenment and a response to conservatism. Right, it's kind of a movement away from both of those particular moments. And what you're going to find is that it's kind of this idea that they're returning to the original pure religion. Right, we're not going to be super conservative. We're not going to be just secular, like the Enlightenment, but we're going to actually show you the way that religion is really meant to be, right? So here it's going to be a movement away from kind of the Puritan type of religion, right? There's going to be what they're going to call the Oxford movement, right, that will take place, right? So there's a kind of this deep religiosity, but also with this attempt of returning to the original, which of course is always a bit of a imagination of what the original was. So it's also a bit of, in a sense, reform that's taking place, though they're not going to see it as reform, as we'll see. This is going to start to develop in other places in Germany, in particular before the Hamburg Temple. There's going to be a service that's going to be organized in somebody's home for a few years in Berlin. This prayer group that's going to happen. It's going to start doing some of these types of things, of some of the changes that some of the Jews there want to see happening in their synagogue. It's eventually going to close, in part because in many of these places, the government won't allow it. The Jewish community is a body, and if the leadership of the Jewish community is opposed to it, you can't go ahead and just start another synagogue. You don't have the authority to do that, because the Jewish community in these places is in a sense like a state within a state in terms of its structure. And so people might try to do this, and there are people who will lobby the government to shut it down for the leadership of the Jewish community, because they don't have the right to simply go ahead and establish their own synagogue. And so there will be those kind of debates that happen, in particular because what's going to happen in Berlin, they're going to try to do something a bit novel. What they're going to do is they're going to say, listen, we are not breaking away from the Jewish community. We are going to continue to pay our taxes to the Jewish community, as we've always done, but out of then our personal funds, we're going to set up this additional place to pray. And so it's not going to be a breakaway from the mainstream, it's going to be this kind of private prayer that we're going to do. And therefore, they're going to try to get in that way to allow it. But there's going to be kind of all of these things that are going to be taking place. But there are people that want it. There's people that are going to it, right? There's people who are joining up within these different communities. And it will continue to grow in Germany throughout these decades. It'll become more and more popular. And we'll see how it's actually going to shift over time. But they do succeed. Hamburg cares less. They don't really care what Jews do. In places like Westphalia, there is concern that if the Jews make their Judaism too modern, there's less impetus for them to convert to Christianity. And maybe there'll even be Christians that will want to be part of this new thing. And so there's actually some opposition from the government to Jews making any changes in their Judaism. They want Judaism to remain the way it was, and if somebody doesn't like it, then that means they have to leave the Jewish community. Right, so there's kind of this assistance from the government to kind of hold on to this more conservative type of Jewish approach. In Hamburg, they don't really care what Jews are doing. They just don't want fights, right? So they do permit them to kind of go and create their own separate synagogue. What's motivating the reform, right? What's motivating these changes? And we'll talk about what reform even means. But part of it is, again, they want to be part of broader society. And again, we're talking about specifically within the German Ashkenaz milieu. They want to conduct themselves or to feel that they are acting in more refined type of ways, right? They don't want the shtiebel. They don't want the kind of synagogue experience, which is people milling about and people saying things at different decibel levels within the prayers. Right, and kind of something which is a bit more decorous, right, in terms of kind of the experience of the synagogue, right? As you remember how embarrassed the Jews in England were after Samuel Pepys reported on what he had seen, right? But that happens here in the 1600s, right? This is happening in the 1800s in Germany, right? The Jews here are already very socially engaged. We'll talk about that when we talk about what happens here. In this context, but it's going to be a bit different for the German Jews. It's kind of their first foray since the late 18th century, where they're now being able to participate in society, and so they want to feel that their Jewish life resembles kind of broader society in the way that things are conducted, in the way that the churches are conducted, right, where things are very, lots of decorum,
and things are very kind of refined, and there's kind of a focus on the music that takes place there. Obviously, there's going to be organs, right? So there's a sign of, you know, that's how religion should feel, right? Religion should feel. I mean, it's a little hard for us to talk about because that's the way Spanish and Portuguese are, which is going to be part of the story about what's going on over here. But within the Ashkenazi context, that just isn't the experience. In fact, if you go to an Ashkenazi shul today, it depends which ones you go to, but certainly if you go into ones that are more still very Eastern European, that's not the atmosphere of those synagogues, right? It's not making any judgment statement on it, right? But it's a different type of atmosphere. If you walk into a shul or something like that, a different kind of environment. And so they're trying to feel like they're fitting into this new milieu of the West, and they want their synagogues to reflect that, in part because that's just what they want, that the tastes that they have. Another part of it is perhaps they feel that they will not receive full emancipation if they don't conduct themselves in more in those kinds of ways that seem more Christian, perhaps, or more German, or simply just more kind of keeping with the times in terms of the atmosphere of the place. And so they want it to feel that a synagogue fits into modern times as much as and that it doesn't feel like it's part of some just old, forgotten, medieval world. And to them, this is the way that you do that. And so it's about what they see is kind of very Kantian, this idea of like the historic development. And they see that Judaism is also going through a historic development, and that things shift, things change over time, and this is emancipation, it impacts their social engagements, and they want Judaism to kind of take its place in the modern world, right? So this is the synagogue for modern times. Yes, Dr.
Wasn't it also a desperate plea to escape from the concept of the ghetto?
Well, they're not in ghettos. But it is that idea that they want to take their place in modern society. Yeah.
Got two things. Yeah. One is that the traditional Ashkenazi service is a group of individuals coming together to pray. And as long as you've got certain fixed points, people go at their own pace.
Yeah.
The reform, based on the Sephardi, is a congregation which has a different structure in terms of the way in which it organizes its service. The other thing is, of course, that that's just the period in Germany where there's beginning to be acceptance of Jews into professions. Very slow.
Right, so it's part of the social integration, yeah.
And I'm sure that a lot of them felt that the nearer they were without giving up their Judaism to the society they want to get into,
it would ease the process. Exactly, absolutely. So the question is what are they advocating? What are they doing, right? So that's one way to look at it. Another term might be acculturating, right? The question is, what are they actually doing? I don't mean to kind of use terms. Let's not define them. But what are they actually doing? So what they're doing is not what we think of when we think of reform today, right? And obviously reform in England means something different than reform in America. So what are they actually doing? So I'll tell you what they're not doing. They have separate seating in that temple. They keep 2 days of Chag in that temple. They still have prayers in Hebrew. They still have references to Zion. This is not the reform of the 1840s, the radical reform that we'll take a look at, right? Those are not the things that they are changing. So the question is what are they actually changing in there? So exactly. So what they're going to do is a few things. One, they are going to add a bit of vernacular, right? They want there to be some things that are going to be said in German. What you have over here is a prayer book, which is produced for the temple. This is the cover page, right? It was produced in 1819, right? So it is going to go from left to right, this particular book, right? They're going to provide. Now, it could be that the Chazan is using the prayers in Hebrew, but this is going to provide for them, right, German for the people that don't know Hebrew or that prefer that or that can connect to that somewhat more. They are going to insist on a degree of decorum within the synagogue, right, in the structure, in the place that people are, that people are not allowed to kind of just scream things out, right? There's going to be kind of an expectation of one's behavior in the synagogue. One of the things that's going to be important is going to be pronunciation. They're going to adopt the Portuguese or Sephardic pronunciation for their Hebrew. We'll talk about why that is, but they're going to adopt that. They are going to make some liturgical changes. One of the important changes that they're going to make is they are actually going to drop many of the Piyutim, many of the medieval poems that have become part of the Ashkenazi service that they find that make the service long or that people don't really understand or difficult to kind of get what's going on. They're going to remove them. But what they are going to do is that they're actually going to add several Sephardic Piyutim, which are much easier to understand, the Sephardic Piyutim. So they're going to add Adir Vinaor, Adon HaSilichot, El Nora Alila, right? They're going to actually add, right, melodies that here from Spanish and Portuguese we would be familiar with. They're gonna start using them. So they actually are borrowing several things from the Sephardim as they do this. We're gonna understand why, we'll look at why in a moment, but they are adopting many Sephardic components. The language, the liturgy. One thing they are going to do is they're going to remove the reference to sacrifices, actually, or the prayer for sacrifices. So what I have over here is showing you side by side a prayer book. So what you see over here is on the right side, we say, Yiratzon min lefanecha, right? May be your will, Lord our God, right? That you shall return and have mercy upon us and on your sanctuary, right, with abundant mercy, and you should build it soon, right? And then we say, right, and so we have these references to doing that, right, that we should get kare pizureinu mibein hagoyim, right, you should gather us from among the nations, and bring us l'tzion irecha berina, right, take us to your city, l'Yerushalayim beit mikdashcha, right, to the temple, right, and there we will bring the korbanot, and so on. What they say over here is, may be the will of Lord our God, shetigal brachim v'ratzon areshet sifateinu bimkom korbanot chovoteinu. Right? May be, Lord our God, that you will accept the utterances of our lips in the place of our sacrifices. Right? And so they are praying that that is their vision of the future. Right? And they will not have all of the same references, right? To the Mikdash, right, to the temple, and so on. So they will still have references to Zion, more as a concept or as a thing that God will return to Zion, but that we're okay where we are, right? We're not looking to return to the sacrifices and so on. So they're kind of trying to do what they feel is more rational, right? They don't want to have references to that we're going to leave and go to Zion, because then are we really good citizens if we're praying for a return to Zion, right? So they may hold on to the idea of redemption, but in more universalistic terms, or that God will return to Zion, or that maybe some of their people will go to Zion, but not us. You know, we love living in Berlin, you know, Hamburg. We love being in Germany, right? We're not looking to do that. So they are making some adjustments to the prayers. But as we're going to see, they're not making some severe ones. This is going to cause a major, major fight. There's going to be a huge publication that's going to come out called Ela Divrei HaBrit, which is going to be a compilation of rabbinic responsa from like 20 different rabbis from around Europe condemning the Hamburg Temple. And I'll just quote to you here what it says. This is from the front page. It says, Asur l'shanot seder ha-tfilah ha-nechona b'Yisrael, right? That you cannot change the order of prayer, min birchot hashachar, from the morning blessings, ad aleinu l'shabach, until you get to aleinu, meaning the whole thing, right? from A to Z, you can't change a thing. Asur lihitpalel seder tefillah halaz bilashon acher, you cannot say the prayers in any other prayer, chutz milashon hakodesh, except for in the holy tongue. And so, they say you can't use vernacular. And the third one here, Asur linagen bebet takneset bishum kli shir b'shabbat u'b'yom tov. You cannot play any musical instruments in the synagogue on Shabbat and holidays. Afilu al yidei eno Yisrael. Even if the person playing the musical instrument is not a Jew. Right? So some of the places were saying, well, we'll have an organ, but we'll have a Gentile that will play that will play. So they go out, and there's other things in here where they kind of try to, you know, make these responses against, you know, the whole project that they're doing. Obviously, they people aren't going to listen. You know, the Hamburg temple doesn't close, and there will be orthodoxy in Germany as well. But the reform movement obviously is going to take off. Yes. No, they will. They seemingly do. Yeah. Now, again, part of this is a question, is that you sometimes dealing with people who, and that's part of the issue with kind of going on reform, is that you have people who are obviously personally less observant, right? And so some of those people obviously might be the people who are more open to a synagogue like this. One of the things that they find, or at least they claim, is that they have people who will come to the temple who haven't gone to synagogue in 15 years because they finally have a place that they feel, you know, is in line with their thinking. So, you know, while some people will see it as a way, a movement away from Judaism, other people will see it as a way to re-engage with their Judaism, right? Depending on kind of what perspective you take when you look at it. Yes?
Do they also accept patrilineal descent?
No. No, no. This is really kind of like, I mean, if I were to sum up what we're talking about, I mean, let's take a look at what they actually do change, right? Pronunciation, having a German language sermon, decorum. I mean, those are things that we just, Orthodox synagogues do those things nowadays, right? And so a lot of the kind of the, not entirely, but a number of kind of their initial kind of changes are things that ultimately today we don't really think of as being some radical kind of shift. And a lot of it is more kind of the, what we would almost might call the like, the clothing of it, right? But not actually changing the thing itself, besides for a few of the adjustments that we mentioned. And they seem to be using as their model the Portuguese, the Sephardic Jews, right? Where the Sephardic Jews are, I mean, the vernacular we use is Portuguese, right? So there'll be a discussion here about starting to get English language, but it's not like they've been speaking in a Jewish language of Yiddish or something like that, right? So they're looking at what the Spanish and Portuguese are doing, where they conduct, we're already very Westernized. We've been in the West for a long time. And one of the things they're gonna do, and this is where kind of historians look at it, where they refer to as, there's a famous article from a few decades ago by Izmir Shorsh, which is called The Myth of Sephardic Supremacy, which describes the way that 19th century German Jews looked at Sephardic Jews as the best, as the ideal form of Judaism. This book recently came out called German Jewry and the Allure of the Sephardic by John Efron. And what they're essentially describing is that when they began to make these adjustments, they wanted to somehow do it in a way that didn't feel like a break from the past, but as a return to the way that things had originally been. And they held up the Sephardic Jews as their model for that, right? Particularly looking at medieval Sephardic Jews, where they were doctors and poets, right? And philosophers, right? While also being Jews, right? And that they wrote Rambam wrote in Arabic, right? That they're engaging with the vernacular as well. And kind of looking at that and saying, wow, you know, we're not changing. We're just being like the Sephardic Jews are. And certainly when you look at the Sephardic Jews that would have been in their surroundings, who had been in the West already for several centuries already and were wearing, you know, clothing like everybody else, and whose synagogues already, to some degree, reflected the Western milieu, that they went ahead and said, we're just going to be more like that. And so the adoption of Sephardic pronunciation was a sense of saying, that's the true pronunciation, right? That bringing in a Sephardic chazan was someone who could pronounce the Hebrew in that way, right? It's kind of just practical. You need someone who knew how to do that. And that there is this kind of sense of they're trying to legitimize what they're doing by saying, we're just doing what the Sephardic Jews had been doing. What's going to happen And this is kind of where the story goes, and we'll conclude with this. In the 1840s, the Hamburg is going to come out with a new Siddur, a new prayer book, and reformers in other places in Germany are going to castigate it as being insufficient, that it's not being driven sufficiently by ideology, and that if you take kind of ideology, you actually would make much more severe reforms, right? So during the 1820s and 30s, while you may have had some reform in practice, you're going to start having developed a reform ideology that goes ahead and says, you know, looks at Judaism as a whole and says, you know, do we believe in Messiah? Do we believe in resurrection of the dead? Do we believe in, you know, all these ideas? And if these ideas no longer fit with modern thinking, then we should strip our prayer book of all of these ideas in a consistent and, you know, kind of a careful way. And that actually the prayer book for the modern time should look very different than the prayer book of the Middle Ages. And that's where you start having what we might call radical reform, right? Where you have profound changes that will take place because it's going to be driven less by kind of trying to fit in socially, and it's going to be driven now much more by ideology, to the extent that what they're doing in Hamburg is going to be seen as too conservative and not kind of liberal enough. What's interesting about the Hamburg situation is that, as I mentioned, it's not being driven by Sephardim, but they are being kind of inspired by the Sephardim, right? Which is going to raise our question. We're going to look at reform within the Sephardic community, or the breakaways from the Sephardic community. Is they are breaking away from something which is already very Western. So we're going to have to understand what is exactly that they are doing when they do their breakaways, right? If it's not going to be, they're already in a place which is somewhat Western. It's not going to be, is it ideology at that point that's driving them, right? What's really going on within, you know, in West London, you know, in Charleston, in, you know, New York, when you're going to have these breakaways that are going to take in place there, because those breakaways are coming from Spanish and Portuguese. And so their experience is already very Western, and already lots of decorum and, you know, all of those kinds of things that we just know from coming to Bevis Marks, and that's just what we experience on any given Shabbat. And so this is a good kind of start point to see that kind of that first reform was kind of looking to the Sephardic or the Spanish Portuguese as their model. That won't be the later reform. And so we're going to be looking in this time period at kind of this first stage of reform, which is going to be really about acculturation and kind of fitting in a bit of ideology, but more so about trying to fit in the West. And so that'll raise a question of, you know, then when you have breakaways from Spanish Portuguese, what are those about? And what's really going on with those stories? And we can't simply take our lenses of what reform is today, or what maybe one of those synagogues are today, and say that that's what was going on back then. What was going on back then would have been different than what maybe is going on, you know, at later times. And so we're gonna have to really look at and understand, you know, what are the questions, what are the challenges that are taking place in, you know, the Anglo-American world that are gonna be different than what's happening in the Ashkenazi world during this time period. So what I hope at least can take out of this is that kind of the ideas or kind of the issues that are happening in this kind of shift into this modern time period, kind of the challenges that Jews are having and the aspirations that they have. But as we look to our communities, we're going to be dealing with communities that have already achieved those things, some of them for two centuries. And so the question is going to be what's happening with reform in those places. But what they are going to do is they will be referencing the Hamburg Temple, right? So there will be, well, in some ways it's a different situation, there is going to be crossover. And so starting with Hamburg will be helpful, because when we look at some of those other ones, we're going to see references to Hamburg, and we'll be able to understand what they are doing or what they're not doing. Are they modeling after Hamburg? Are they just using that as an excuse for what they're going to do? It'd be kind of a bit really interesting kind of understand what the polemic is really all about. One final time. Does anyone have any questions? Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you all so much for coming. The next lecture is going to be in May. That one we're going to be doing is B'nai Jeshurun. The dates are all in the emails and on the website. So you can get all that information there. But thank you all so much. This was great. And have a nice day.